every moment in Judaism, we time travel because we're living in the world as it is and the world as it was. And actually, we can see that there's only a thin layer between the two.
Rambling on.
Time moves quickly, and believe it or not, I really can't believe it, this is the penultimate episode in this series of Rabbiting On, and I'm seeing sad faces from my amazing colleagues, Rabbi Miriam and Rabbi Robin. Hello!
Otherwise, when will we get to chat?
I don't know. I know. We'll have to set up just chat time that isn't recorded for listeners.
You know what we need to do? We need to make sure we sign up for the same baked in, to sit on the same baked ins. Then people could have a rabbiting on baked in.
We should do that.
We need to make that happen.
That'd be awesome.
So I am Rabbi Debbie Young Summers, and as always, it is a delight to be with you as we begin our rabbiting on together. It's Purim time, and it's also very, very close to International Women's Day. So we've got lots of things to talk about this week. From those of you who are enjoying the view on YouTube, you might be able to see that we're going to be thinking about Purim this week. So for the sake of those not watching the glory that is our costumed faces, what are you all wearing and why? Let's start with Robin.
Thanks. Well, this year, I've got a strange thing on my head and I can't quite tell whether it's a feather or hair, but it's feathers. But
isn't it a halo?
I've come dressed as the most wonderful Jewish woman in our history. I don't know if you can guess who it is. I've got black wings on. I've got like the black headpiece is just, that's not anything to do with it.
Is she from Isaiah?
She's not from Isaiah.
Oh, so it's not Lilith.
Oh, I think she's mentioned in Isaiah.
Lilith?
Yeah, Lilith.
She's
sorry.
Only mentioned,
she's mentioned
in Isaiah.
She's mentioned in Isaiah, lying down, watching everyone. But yes, I am Lilith, the first woman who flew away, as it says, the rabbinic tradition. So I thought I'd inhabit Lilith for International Women's Day / Purim this year.
Awesome. How about you, Miriam?
So it's interesting. I've just put on this short wig. And it's a nice pink wig with a crown on, really, just to show that there is no glass ceiling and that women can rise to the top with their own
nice
identity and their own sense of self-expression. But looking at myself with a slightly bobbed short haircut, all I can actually see is my mum looking back at me, which is that kind of also that weird time kind of thing. My mum sadly died in 2003. And so we're getting closer to the age that she was when, that I am kind of getting closer to the age that she was when she died. And so, like, you know, there's that kind of time stops in essence, and you always remember someone at a certain age. So she stopped aging and I have not stopped aging. And therefore I just suddenly catch myself now and again and go, oh, it's my mum. So yes. That's, oof. I've clearly come as multiple generations without necessarily meaning to.
And that sense of how time chains and impacts us is one of the things we're going to talk about this morning.
Who are you, Debbie, with your gorgeous locks?
So I am wearing a ridiculous ombre green and black wig.
It's great. It's not ridiculous. It's fabulous.
Which is very similar. It's not the actual one I wore, but it's very similar to the wig that I was put in when some of my wonderful girlfriends bought me my 40th birthday present, which was to be made over in drag. And I transformed into Beth Din, who is my drag persona. So
I love that. You see, we should do a Beth Din, all three of us.
In drag.
As Beth Din. Yeah, it'd be brilliant.
Can you imagine the poor candidates? They're terrified enough as it is. And they come in to be greeted by, you know, me having had my face beaten for 3 hours. And but of course, Purim is all about the fun, the silliness, the turning things upside down, the costumes. It falls on, as every year, on the 14th of Adar, 5783. That's where we are this year.
Is that not where we start? It happened on the 14th of Adar.
Oh, I don't know that one. That's lovely, Miriam.
It's called The Whole Megillah. Look it up on YouTube. It's a great song.
Excellent.
Great.
We'll put that in the show notes for everybody to enjoy.
You can all sing along.
So Last year, of course, Purim fell on a different day of the Gregorian calendar, because the Hebrew calendar doesn't always align with our English calendar. In fact, very rarely. Every 19 years, apparently, it will align again. So Judaism follows a lunar calendar, which means our months begin when the moon is at its thinnest. And actually, that's a really fantastic link for us this week, because the Gregorian calendar, every year, 8th of March is International Women's Day. And rabbinically, women are very much connected to the moon and the cycles of the moon. And we also know physiologically that actually women's bodies and hormones and moods are quite often affected by the cycles of the moon. And there's some amazing conversations in the Talmud about women and what they do by the light of the full moon and things like that. But
can I ask, does anyone know why? I mean, I'm just going to assume you both know and I don't. So let's teach the viewers why the 8th of March for International Women's Day. Like, what happened on the 8th of March?
I don't actually know.
No,
is
I
that
don't.
When the like suffragettes won the vote, or I don't know.
Someone
my niece
Google.
Would know this, because my niece has got obsessed with the suffragettes. I feel like she would know all the women's history that we obviously should.
I'm Googling. And other search engines do also exist.
I'm going to talk about the link between women and the moon while Miriam Googles why International Women's Day is on the 8th of March. But there's a
that's Rabbi Google.
One of my favorite rabbinic midrashim tells us that women have Rosh Chodesh, the new moon, off as a day of rest. And the story goes that the reason we are gifted this day of rest when we shouldn't work and everyone should cook for us, and because obviously we're doing that stuff all the rest of the time, is that when Aaron was collecting up gold to build the golden calf, the women were so pious that they refused to hand over their earrings and their gold necklaces to be melted down into the golden calf. And this, of course, was an act of great piety. It had nothing to do with the fact that women will not hand over their jewelry when asked. Miriam, why is International Women's Day on the 8th of March? What does Rabbi Google say?
Apparently, after women gained suffrage in Soviet Russia in 1917, at the beginning of the February Revolution, the textile workers rose up, began to demonstrate, with a demonstration that eventually engulfed the whole city, demanding bread and peace and an end to the war. Started on the 8th of March, 1917, in Petrograd, and therefore that's the date that International Women's Day memorializes.
On. I was looking at some really interesting Twitter discourse yesterday around International Women's Day, and people saying that it's become performative feminism, which I thought was quite interesting. You see lots of companies tweeting like what they're doing to celebrate International Women's Day. And there's an amazing bot. I don't know if any of you have come across it. It's something like Gender Pay Gap bot. And it basically replies to each of these big companies with the gender pay gap of that company. And it's such a brilliant reminder of why we still need to be having these conversations about women's roles and women's work and the mental load that women bear, and the fact that there is still a gender pay gap and it's not all an equal playing field.
Isn't there also that with like anything that you particularly do for a day, you know, it's like, if mitzvah day is the only day you're doing a mitzvah, then there's something wrong, right?
Like, yes.
You know.
Yes, every day is mitzvah day.
If you only tell your partner you love them on Valentine's Day, it's a problem. You know, everything.
You were reading my article. So we've got this strange sort of conflation this year, which happens just by chance because the lunar calendar and the Gregorian calendar happen to have coincided of Purim and International Women's Day. But of course, Purim is a really interesting time to talk about women. This is one of the stories where women really play a starring role. Are you Team Esther or Team Vashti, or do we not need to divide things up that way?
It's interesting, isn't it? This is what I get obsessed with, so I'll try not to like just go off on one.
Oh, but please go off on one.
Okay, fine. So I always read Vashti and Esther along with Eve and Lilith. And I think as a kind of foursome, they really represent the challenges of what it is to be in a world that is still dominated, still a male world. And that's within the synagogue, I think, and also in the wider world. Eve and Esther were both able to find kind of a way to stay within and create change and be. Although Eve's act of resistance was to eat the apple and give it to Adam, and then they fled, but they stayed in some way, apart from Lilith, who flew off and said, no, it's like the first wave of feminism, you know, like we're going to go and burn our bras, we're going to go into a completely different world. So Lilith and Vashti weren't able to stay in their way because it was just too hard and not okay. And there's a really, like that I really find that thin line between... and I was speaking to a good friend recently, like what counts as staying? When can you make a difference from within? And when is it okay to step out? And I think that is, as women in our world, I did a really interesting chat with loads of amazing students from the University of Salford yesterday about this, about when someone was working in construction as a young woman and having to make those decisions all the time about, do you go in strong? Do you actually go in softly and more feminine? Like you have to play certain roles to be heard in certain spaces. And sometimes you can't be heard and you have the privilege, if you have the privilege, to be able to leave. So I think it's fascinating, the Vashti, Lilith and the Eve and the Esther conundrum, because it feels very real to me. Like, you know, we read texts that are set so many years ago, but they are so on point. Like I'm living the reality of what they live today in everything that I do and in every interaction that people have of us as women, particularly like female public leaders as well.
And because their stories only tell a snapshot, right? So actually we don't hear what happens to Vashti afterwards. And actually, you know, Does Vashti end up being the one that didn't compromise herself and actually is able to live a much fuller and richer life? Does Esther always end up living the compromise because she's kind of in the palace forevermore? You know, it's interesting that, you know, it's all been in the press again today with Meghan and Harry having to give up their house at Windsor. That piece of like, what does it mean to stand up and to leave, and what does it mean to stay and be part of the structure within, not likening either to Esther and Vashti of the, you know, but, you know, it's an interesting, what does it take its toll of you? I've found over the years, our kindergarten teachers have really been aware of kind of changing some of the stories that, you know, even when I started here, I don't know, it's been like 15 years ago, the kids were still singing about like Esther was brushing her hair and isn't Esther beautiful and da da da. And now the narrative that we use around a Purim very much more about around consent for Vashti, like what does it mean to be made to feel uncomfortable, and what does it mean to be put in a situation that's you're being embarrassed and shamed in front of people. And for Esther, what does it mean to be the kind and responsible one? What does it mean to hide your identity or tell who you are? Even without the four-year-olds, like the conversation around these characters has shifted, and that it's not all about which one's more beautiful and therefore who the real princess is.
But actually traveling through Jewish time, we also see that shift happening. In a way, we feel like we're making progress through time as we travel onwards. But I often wonder how much progress, like are we kind of also moving a bit cyclically rather than straight, particularly when it comes to women's rights? You know, we've made lots of gains, but at the same time, what we're seeing in America at the moment with Roe v. Wade, and we're moving backwards in time in some ways, those challenges of what it is to continually strive for change. Are we actually progressing?
Yeah, and I think that's such a powerful question as well. And also like thinking about change and organizing and campaigning, you know, community organizing teaches that every action has a reaction. So I think that you do get a spiral of time in that every time we move, you know, we might say forward because we're more liberal, like we're evolving, you get a reaction to that and more conservatism comes. So you end up doing a kind of spiral because people are reacting against the change that's coming as well. And I guess part of the question for ourselves is, and I think Miriam was like talking to this as well, of like being part of that and being at the front line of it, either as leaders or whatever where individual roles are, is like, well, what price are we paying for it? And there's always something about making sure we're protected and have allies and working together, which is why I love bringing those four women together as well, because the power, Rabbi Sheila Shulman, Zichrona Livracha, used to talk about the power of women and how actually, and this is what I'm going to do part of my PhD on, is that like, you don't often get women together in the Torah or the Tanakh acting together. There are some examples, daughters of Lochad, you've got the women of Bethlehem in the book of Ruth, but very often the women are separated. Esther and Vashti are not brought together. We don't in the text. Even Lilith definitely aren't. And so the power comes and the threat also comes when women together are talking or sharing stories, and we start to realize, hang on, you're being treated like this. Maybe this isn't about me. Maybe there's a systemic issue, and that's when change starts to happen. So that's why I love this podcast, because we get to do that with all the listeners as well. But also the power of reading the women together, of actually not hiding Vashti away. And we always cheer for her. I've got a great thing that I sing from Ritual Well about Vashti, to really lift up her voice alongside Esther and see them as sisters in battle, expressing themselves in different ways at different moments of time.
I think also whenever there's any kind of sense of change, there's the, like, sometimes you push so far forward that then there is an okay to step back. So I was teaching last Sunday the history of Reformed Judaism, and it's very obvious that we took many steps forward. We made many changes to achieve a sense of who we wanted to be. And then I think over the decades, there have been kind of steps back in terms of, like, finding a traditionalism, or actually we don't need to have gone that far in order to have achieved what we wanted to achieve. And I think there's often that, whether it's about women in leadership roles, whether it's actually about the work-life balance of women who are in full-time employment and also, you know, mothers and, you know, running the house and the things that we won't, you know, that I won't put down. I even see from a younger, I don't think of myself as a kind of an older mum, but I see now from younger women much more able to say, I've got nothing to prove. I'm happy to share this stuff more equally. Whereas I sort of felt for a long time, I have a lot to prove. I need to be at work and at home. I need to be earning money and looking after, you know, my child. And it's hard.
That's a really interesting point, though, in terms of the history of Reformed Judaism. Like, people are quite often surprised that we weren't actually founded on egalitarian principles.
No.
Right? We weren't
West
ordaining
was
women
built with
immediately.
A
women's
gallery.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Eshet Chayil is still written above the doors in the upstairs. And it's something that, again, shows us how time moves us on.
I mean, I think because we've kind of had this really interesting theme for Purim that we were thinking about time as well as women and Purim. And, you know, Purim's all about reversal, isn't it? It's all topsy-turvy and as well. And I've been teaching, I think I mentioned this, like, I love it, so I'll just keep mentioning it, the Prophets module at the moment at Leo Beck College. And we did a really, really difficult piece in Ezekiel all about gender and violence, and it was awful. But it felt so real as well. Like, the stories that we read in the, you know, these ancient texts, we can kind of dismiss, and lots of people do, like, and say, well, it's of its time. It's historically, like, it's just to that time. It wasn't meant in that way. And I read a commentary where it says in Amos, cows of Bashan talking about a set of women. And they said, the commentary is, it probably wasn't meant to be offensive calling women cows because it meant that they were rich and plump. I was like, oh yeah, come on. Like, even then it would have been seen in a different way. And now we know that women's bodies are still used in that way. So I think the beauty of Judaism, and I was saying, you know, in our pre-recording chat, every week on Shabbat, every moment in Judaism, we time travel because we're living in the world as it is and the world as it was. And actually, we can see that there's only a thin layer between the two. And the rabbis always used to say that there's no end and no beginning to Torah. And I think that's part of it, is that we return to the same text each week, anew and, like, different, because we've experienced different things each year, that we're going to see the text in a different way. As it says, turn it over and over, you see different things. So we're, like, consistently time traveling in this world of returning to the same but different. I think that's so powerful, because I'm not so keen about the idea of, like, progression, of, like, what that means. I think it's, like, how we're progressing rather than whether we're progressing, if you know what I mean, like, values and integrity and how we're acting on the way. And I love that I'm caught in this cycle of, like, never-ending return, and it makes living, like, a very mortal, fragile life much easier, I think, knowing that time isn't so, you know, just linear from A to Z.
Oh, And one of the greatest gifts, I think, of Judaism is the fact that it allows you to hold on to time, right? Like, I think in the modern world particularly, it feels like everything just has to keep going as fast as possible and yeah. on this kind of non-stop kind of conveyor belt of time. And what Judaism gives us, whether it's Shabbat, whether it's the life cycle moments, whether it's the festivals, even around mourning, it's so much about, let's just hold on to this kind of sense of holding and counting and marking time. What does it mean to acknowledge that the first week is different to the next month, which is different to that first year, which means that you want to keep coming back each year to this moment, because now this period of time has a different feel for you in your very own particular family moment. And I think that thing of holding on to the markers of time is a real gift.
There was a yeah. beautiful analogy that our teacher Jeremy Schoenfeld made at Leo Beck College, and I assume he's still making it 15 years later, but who knows, about the Jewish year as a metaphor or almost microcosm of the Jewish life cycle and a life lived. So we're sort of born at Rosh Hashanah and learning how to act in the world at Yom Kippur and enjoying childlike fun at Hanukkah. And by the time we come to Purim, we're really inhabiting the space of the teenager and the boisterous silliness, drinking, turning things upside down, pushing boundaries, testing things out before we get more grown up at Pesach, meet our lover, become married at Shavuot, and then start to decline into the heat of the summer and Tisha B'Av, to be reborn again. And that sense of, you know, this is all a cycle that continues regardless. I wonder where God sits in that cycle, having set all of this in motion potentially, or being the force that drives it. What is God's role in this scope of time? Is God within time or outside of time?
It's a big question. I've always loved the Kabbalistic name for God, Ein Sof, there's no end. And I was teaching our amazing conversion class the rabbinic dictum phrase, which is Ein L'Davar Sof, which is when the rabbis have kind of got to the end of an exhaustive conversation and gone to every extreme of the conversation, and a rabbi just goes, Ein L'Davar Sof, there's going to be no end to this, and they just move on. And we actually were doing a conversion class, and one of, like, weeks after, and someone said, Ein L'Davar Sof. I was like, all right, calm down, because they were just like, we're not going to get anywhere. So I love the idea, and I know for me, my understanding of God, I don't believe in a personal God, but like my understanding of God is expansiveness and largeness. And that is really radical for a woman, because I'm always taught, and I've suffered with, like, you know, food things and bodies, loads of us have for my whole life, like being large and expansive is not ours. Like, actually my role of a woman, I'm taught, is to be as small as possible, not only in body but also in voice and spirit. So for me, it's really like an activism to see God as expansive as well. And leading on from what Miriam was saying, I really like Heschel's work on Shabbat, and I was listening to a great podcast actually on it this morning, that we're so concerned in the world we live in about the space we inhabit, building, working, productivity, and actually God and expansion is much more about time. It's much bigger than that, and it's recognizing that our worth and value isn't what we're outputting or what our bodies look like, but actually stepping into something really expansive, the vastness that's in front of us. So I love thinking about God as like Ein Sof, and being part of that bigness.
One of my favorite things about our Siddur that came out 2008, but we're still calling the new Siddur, is the use of eternal, when we used to say Lord. And it's a translation of the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter name of God, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. And, you know, obviously Lord is a very masculine word, and it was used because we always say Adonai when we look at Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. But Adonai means Lord and is one of the names of God. But actually Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is a sort of verbal form that implies it was, it is, and it will be. So eternal is a much more accurate translation of the word we're looking at. And takes away all that gender stuff.
And also, of course, the word God and God isn't mentioned in Megillat Esther, of the Scroll of Esther. It is written in later translations, or like
interpretations.
Like, there's prayers that Esther does, like, to God to show how pious she is, because they're so concerned God isn't there. But that kind of makes sense. I loved Jeremy Schonfield's take on that at college, so he was still definitely teaching it 5-6 years ago, because it's really powerful. It's very true, isn't it? But God's missing, because in that time, you know, you're very self-orientated, you know, you're not thinking about that expansiveness in the same way. So yeah, interesting, God's not mentioned at all.
I also wonder if there's something about the God inhabiting also the spaces of time that we don't have the language for. You know, the first letter of Torah is a bet of Bereshit. And one of the commentaries on that is that the shape of the bet means that you encourages you to look forward and not look above or below or behind, that there are periods of time and space that we don't know the answers to, and that we don't have language for. And so actually all we can do is kind of look forward. And that Judaism is really helpful, I think, in not giving us too much language for the after, the ha'olam haba, the afterlife, the what comes next. It doesn't try and presuppose that it understands or that it knows or that we have a language for it, which again leaves it with that sort of openness of being able to say, we don't always have a language for time because it isn't something we have experienced yet. We can only have language for that which we've experienced. And leaving us without language can sometimes be helpful too.
And what I love about that lack of language about what's to come and the multiple approaches, meaning we don't really know, is it means we are supposed to focus on this world and this life and making the most of it as well as we can, which to some extent is part of what Purim's about. Be in the moment, enjoy the fun. It's not natural for all British Jews to get dressed up and get a bit tipsy, you know, letting go of those inhibitions and being really present in the moment. But I think for me in Jewish time, it's all about how do we make the most of where we are now, how we are now.
And I do wonder whether as Jews, because we live in, whether we're conscious of it or not, understanding the world as not being linear, and shout out to my Star Trek fellow fans and Deep Space Nine, non-linear time, won't go into it now, but brilliant. They also care about this stuff. But being brought up in a world where we understand we return and that time in some ways doesn't move on and does move on, how it influences us all in our world. You know, Einstein created the concept of space-time and all of the work that he did. There is something about being Jewish and living in Jewish time and spaces, that we enter a different world, or different worlds, maybe multiverse. We definitely need to do a sci-fi thing. I feel like this is, I've got a lot, I'm like stopping myself from going on a lot of different tangents around different sci-fi things. But we do inhabit different worlds all the time as Jews, and I'm sure it's influenced Einstein. It'd be interesting to see whether he felt he was being particularly Jewish in what he was doing with relativity and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we live these worlds all the times.
You might have to set us some reading before that or some watching homework.
Oh, I would be delighted. Yeah.
Sadly, we're running out of time on this penultimate episode of Rabbiting On. We've got one more to come in this season. But as always, we want to thank our wonderful, wonderful listeners, each and every one of you, for listening and for being in touch with the show. We always love hearing your ideas and thoughts. There's one episode that you can get your ideas in for a topic, but maybe if you write in and it doesn't make it into the last episode, we can put it into season 3. Fingers crossed that might happen. And you can always reach us here at Rabbiting On Towers by emailing media@rjuk.org or on our WhatsApp number, which is 07922575583. We are back very, very soon. We hope you either have or have had a fantastic Purim. And we will see you all soon. Thank you so much, Miriam and Robin.
Thank you.
Chag Purim, Chag Purim, Chag Gadolah Yehudim, Masechot Rosh Hashanah.
Bye.
Yay.
Have fun. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.